Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and my great producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Before we begin our show, we always start with the powerful testimony of Lieutenant Colonel Vindman when he was testifying before the impeachment hearings of 2019. I thought that after watching him and his brother get walked out of the White House, oh, Arnie, things have gotten so much worse. But in order to remind you, we play Lieutenant Colonel Vindman's testimony every day. We will continue to do it between now and November of 2020, the election day. Lieutenant Colonel Vindman.
Next month will mark 40 years since my family arrived in the United States as refugees. When my father was 47 years old, he left behind his entire life and the only home he had ever known to start over in the United States so his three sons could have a better and safer lives. His courageous decision inspired a deep sense of gratitude in my brothers and myself and instilled in us a sense of duty and service. All three of us have served or are currently serving in the military. My little brother sits behind me here today. Our collective military service is a special part of our family's history, a story in America. I'm grateful for my father's brave act of hope 40 years ago and for the privilege of being an American citizen and public servant, where I can live free and free of fear for mine and my family's safety. Dad, I'm sitting here today in the U.S. Capitol talking to our elected professionals. Talking to our elected professionals is proof that you made the right decision 40 years ago to leave the Soviet Union and come here to the United States of America in search of a better life for our family. Do not worry. I will be fine for telling the truth. Thank you again for your consideration. I'll be happy to answer your questions.
If it's Friday, it must be Texas. If it's Texas, it must be Scott Braddock. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He is the voice of Texas. He is the dean of the Austin Press Corps. Let me just say something, Scott.
Yeah.
When I first met you years ago now, for a segment we referred to as Indictment Watch,
yeah,
I thought that our relationship would end after your former governor decided not to continue his race for president.
Way back in 2014 is when Rick Perry was indicted. In January of this year, that seemed like yesterday, but now it seems like 4 million years ago.
You're absolutely right. And I am just going to say publicly, I am so grateful we never let go. Because it turns out, one, you've been a powerful teacher. And as we've come to expect and understand with each passing hour, we understand the relevance and the importance of Texas.
Oh, sure.
Because it really is such a huge driver, both economically and politically. And this week, with the incredibly powerful 3-hour and plus services for George Floyd in Houston, it was just a remarkable moment. And you began to understand how sort of everything is now falling together. And where is it falling together? It's falling together in Texas.
Wasn't it just incredible to watch that celebration of life? When an African-American congregation comes together to celebrate one of their own who has fallen for whatever reason, it is just a beautiful thing to behold. I don't know how many of those types of services you've actually attended in person. They had to, do the social distancing, people wearing masks and people having to, sit further away from each other in the church there. But they brought so many people together to talk about somebody who, look, let's take all the arguments off the table that some people try to make. You probably see this poison on Facebook and on Twitter where people say, well, this is a guy who had a rap sheet. This is a guy who had been arrested before for different things. Forget that. It doesn't matter. Number one, the police, it doesn't matter what the guy had done before. They don't get to do that. They don't get to do what he did that we saw on that video from Minneapolis, right, Arnie? That is not allowed, no matter what the guy was accused of before. Putting the knee on the neck, leading to asphyxiation, which is what we're told killed George Floyd, not allowed. You just can't do it. And then you look at the fact that when you have a celebration like that, there is an acknowledgement that we're all sinners. We're all flawed. We all have problems. And you know what we need to do? Work on them. Because guess what? We're still here. And we have a chance to honor the life that was lost by continuing to make what we have better. And that's what these things are about. It's what the music is about. It's what the speeches are about. It's about moving forward and trying to fix the problems that we have at the same funeral. we saw Governor Greg Abbott, who I'll give him some credit, said, and I saw him on CNN as it was being streamed, his comments from outside the church. He was simply saying that we have got to get together. He had met with the family of George Floyd and talked to them about grief and talked to them about starting to have the conversation on solutions moving forward. Abbott had said that we can't allow anything like what happened to George Floyd in Minneapolis happen in Texas. Now, at the exact same time, and it was a sort of a weird statement. That's about where my credit for him ends for this morning. At about the same time, yeah, we learned, because of the reporting of the Austin American-Statesman and KVU Television here in Austin, that back in March of 2019, there was a man who died, and it was captured on video in police custody where the man was saying the same exact words, "I can't breathe." This guy, Javier Ambler, was the cops attempted to pull him over in Williamson County, which is suburban Austin, just north of Austin. The guy didn't stop, and he led them on a chase for, I think, about 20 miles. He came into the city of Austin, and they caught him in Austin. They put him on the ground, and he had apparently had some underlying conditions. He was cuffed on the ground, and he was on the video saying, "I can't breathe." Now, the Williamson County Sheriff's Department, which pulled him over, in their reporting that was now uncovered in the paperwork, it was uncovered that the reason that they gave chase, that he was such a danger, and there was never anything else said about, you know, whether this person was going to be some harm to the community, they said that it was because he failed to dim his headlights for oncoming traffic, Arnie. And the man is dead. His family didn't know until the reporter, Tony Plahetsky, who's a friend of mine, he had revealed to the parents of the man who passed away what he had been accused of. They didn't even know that. They hadn't heard that from the authorities until the reporter told them. Now, to add insult to injury and to death, this had been captured on video by a show called Live PD. Have you heard of this?
Yes, yes.
Trash TV, Dan Abrams, who's this guy who's you know, still a legal analyst, I think, for ABC News as well. He was tweeting about the fact that what they try to do on their show is provide transparency in policing. So that sounds like a big steaming pile of BS to people around here, Arnie, because they had the tape of what had happened for about 15 months, never revealed it. This is now being investigated by the Travis County District Attorney's Office because the chase started in Williamson County, ended here in Travis County. The District Attorney, Margaret Moore, who's up for re-election, by the way, she's in a Democratic runoff coming up July 14th. And so that, of course, colors this as well, right? I mean, there's, imagine this, Arnie, there's politics going on here. There's a Republican sheriff in the suburbs, a guy named Robert Chody, who is telling people that his officers were justified, that nobody asked them for the tape previously. And he, this sheriff, who seems to a lot of people to be a little out of control, he had demanded that the show, the TV show Live PD, be able to ride along with his officers and capture their actions, you know, for this television program, which people watch on A&E. Just this week, it was announced that that show is being canceled by A&E, along with the show Cops, which I think was going into its 33rd season, something like that. These shows that glorify some of the worst things that police do. Because let's be honest, what are those shows all about? It's about when they arrest people and when they throw them on the ground and all of that. That's what people want to see. It's the drama. The glorification of that, at least for right now, Arnie, seems to be something that people want to put a stop to. The sheriff has fought with the Republican county commissioners in Williamson County about even having these, you know, these film producers go along for the ride. The Williamson County Commissioner's Court has sued the sheriff over it to get him to stop it. And he said that it was okay. There's no transparency with these folks. It had to be uncovered through good old-fashioned journalism at the Austin American-Statesman and at KVU Television, where they did a nice job with it. But look, the governor, back to his comments at the George Floyd funeral, outside the funeral, he had said, you know, he's going to talk to various stakeholders, legislators, and others to try to figure out what to do legislatively going forward. The chairman of the Texas Legislative Black Caucus is a guy named Harold Dutton from Houston, a state representative and a chairman, who said that, well, the governor hasn't reached out to us. So if he's, you know, looking to have a conversation, we're here, we're ready to talk. But think about the various pieces of legislation, and some of them powerful and some of them not as powerful. But some of these acts that have been passed in the time that I've been covering politics, the James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Act, which was signed by Governor Perry years ago, the Sandra Bland Act, which was passed after Sandra Bland died in the Waller County Jail just outside of Houston after she had been arrested. And you remember what Sandra Bland did? She wouldn't put out her cigarette when a DPS officer asked her to do that. The Timothy Cole Act. Timothy Cole was wrongfully imprisoned, and we passed a bill on that to try to, you know, make amends. One of the African-American lawmakers pointed out to me that, you know, here you have all of these pieces of legislation. They're all named for people who either died or were horribly wronged. And so they're always reactive to something that had happened that was terrible. Instead of being proactive and say, look, let's take a different view here. Let's take a different view of policing. You hear all this talk about defunding the police. I think you may have said it. How about reimagine the police? How about let's think about the different ways that we want these folks to interact with our community instead of getting all Ramboed up the way we saw during a lot of these protests?
So let me, a couple of things. I almost want to do a split screen because at the very beginning of the week, we had another reporter on with us who covers New Jersey and New York. He writes for The Chief Leader. He writes for Salon.com. His name is Bob Hedley. He was almost telling us a story that was a parallel of what you just told. Only it involved a state trooper in New Jersey. It ended up with the murder of this young kid who was driving at high speeds and yada, yada, yada. Again, it didn't come out until really, I mean, it happened 2 days before the murder of George Floyd. It had been sat on. Nope, everybody ignored it. The parents weren't told what happened to the kid. If it wasn't for the attorney representing the parents, we would have known nothing because there wasn't even a reporter around to cover or to ask the questions about how did the state trooper kill this guy. You know, I mean, normally that would at least get some curiosity level up. So I almost feel like I want to split the screen and say, listen to Bob Hedley. This is the East Coast. This is New Jersey. Listen to Scott Braddock. This is Texas. What's the story here? But here's my point. And I tweeted this out and nobody has responded to it. If this isn't a story about race, then where are the stories of the state trooper that stepped on, you know, that stopped a white person from speeding and killing them? Where is the story of the white person selling single cigarettes and basically being choked to death so he can't breathe? Where is the story of the white person refusing to put out his cigarette and dying? This isn't race-based. But there must be, because there are more white people in America. I know they speed. I am sure that they probably sell single cigarettes. I'm sure they don't put out their smokes when a cop stops them. How come there are no stories about them emerging during this time? Or is it that they're immediately dealt with because it's a white person? These have been sort of covered up or put under the rug.
Arnie, I heard Rush Limbaugh talking to the folks on The Breakfast Club, which was an interesting interview. I don't know if you listened to that. They had a long conversation. It's worth listening to. It's about 30 minutes. You know, the host of this very popular African-American morning show, and Rush Limbaugh, the leading conservative voice of talk radio, going back and forth. And they asked him that question. They got to this, you know, this point about, you know, what about white people? And Limbaugh said what is often said when this is brought up. If it happened to a white person, you wouldn't even hear about it. Arnie, give me a break. When a white hair salon owner in Dallas could not open, it was the top story on Fox News Channel and everywhere in Texas for a week. And the governor of the state did legal gymnastics to try to get her reopened for her business when there were Latinas in South Texas who were basically accused of the same stuff, of providing hair salon type services to people during the COVID-19 shutdown. And of course, they were arrested and there was no similar outcry for them. Anytime a white person has to put up with any kind of injustice, we all hear about it pretty fast.
I am going to use myself again. You've heard me tell this story before. They were demolishing a building across the street. While they were demolishing the school, there was fencing around it. I kind of didn't necessarily crawl over the fencing, but I kind of found a place where, and I'm kind of looking in the window to see what was going on inside the building. The cops went by me. They didn't arrest me. I wasn't killed. Nobody followed me. They just said, oh, Arnie, will you please stop it? You see the fencing, you're not supposed to be there. And I'm like, oh, I know. I just hate to see all this beautiful, like, you know, architectural sculpture work disappear because you're going to bulldoze it. And they said, well, you know, talk to the school about it, but you can't be there. That was the response. The response was reasonable. It was rational. It told me not to do it. I respected what they told me. They were right. I shouldn't be there. But look at the difference. What is different? I am white. That is what is different.
You're white and you live in a white community. So D.L. Hughley, D.L. Hughley, the comedian and commentator, had said, I think it was on CNN, he was talking about the fact, and you know, if you go and look at the information on this. He's correct. Anytime you have police officers who are disciplined for some reason, that they had used excessive force, or they're one of these folks that they have some concern about for a variety of reasons, when they will discipline this person, then they'll put them back to work. And where they put them back to work is in minority neighborhoods. You, as the white person, get the best cops in your area. Right. And the minorities, you know, he was making the point, you would never have to deal with the cops that they send to our neighborhood. You know, these are the ones who are the problem cops. He was saying that, you know, there's only two professions really where you can keep getting in trouble over the same things that are completely inappropriate. And it's priests and police officers. Instead of getting rid of those terrible cops, you know, we always hear that there are a few bad apples. But I will say, I've got some police officers who are friends, who are great people. One of them is running for the Texas House right now, and I think he's an interesting candidate, and I think he would do a good job. Republican who's here from the Austin area. But look, let's get real. And some of these police officers will say this privately. When they talk about there's only a few bad apples, and they're the ones that cause all the problem, what happens with the police unions and the rest of the police whenever any of them is accused and is seen on video doing terrible things? They all band together. No matter what the person is accused of, no matter what the person did, they all band together and act like, well, you can't punish them because, you know, then that would end up opening the door for us to be punished for other stuff. I mean, at some point, it's the solidarity. But you don't need to show solidarity with someone who has disgraced your profession. You know, you'd want to shove that person out. I'm not sure who said it, but when it comes to, let's think about airline pilots. You couldn't say, oh, we have most of our pilots here at Southwest Airlines, and most of our pilots are fantastic. Now, we do have a few bad apples who just want to crash the plane into a mountain now and then, but nobody would put up with that. You know, you fire that person and they're never an airline pilot again. If they show that kind of tendency, if they have some sort of a problem like that. In no other profession would you put up with that. But in police, they go, oh, well, it's just a few bad apples making everybody look bad.
I'm going to have you go to another topic, but I have to just sort of put a button on this. And that is the combination of what we saw happen with the pedophiles and the Catholic priests and what we're seeing happening now with the police is so similar. Instead of getting rid of them, they reassign them. Instead of having a listing of who these people were, so all parishes would know the priest that was being reassigned to them. Once again, it was sort of this cult-like response. So instead of responding to failure and recognizing that they are trusted, that they are so important to the community. The police are important to the community. The priests are important to the community. Yeah. They are valued and they're trusted. The people that you need to trust and you need to value are the ones that are harming you. Oh my God. It isn't just hurting your relationship with that individual. It is hurting the entire profession. People walked away en masse from the Catholic Church. People walk away from cops now with the defund police. Why? Not because all priests are bad or all cops are bad, but the behavior of the leadership in not dealing with the failure, that's wrong.
Well, when you're entrusted to be the one who is always allowed to have a firearm anywhere that you go, then you have to be held to a higher standard, period.
Exactly. And let's be honest, for a priest, the firearm is the cross. Because you come with all your vulnerability.
They trust
you. Come. It's exactly the same thing. It is in a lot of ways, both of them make you genuflect. I am afraid of a gun. I will drop. I am afraid of a cross when you go into a Catholic church. And what do? They go to their knees. That tells you the power of the instruments they hold. Therefore, trust is absolutely important.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about what's happening politically right now in Texas. Because things, I mean, I guess the Democratic Party had a convention and it was done.
Their stuff, believe me.
So now the question is, so I'm glad you had a convention remote, as you point out. How do I do that voting thing, though?
It's fascinating, Arnie. Since 2018, there have been so many new Democrats in Texas who have been identified, people who came and voted for the first time in 2018, or they've registered to vote since then for a variety of reasons. I mean, in 2018, you had basically three things going on that we've talked about many times. It was excitement for this congressman from nowhere, who came out of nowhere. And some people say El Paso is nowhere. Some people say El Paso is nowhere, but that's not fair. El Paso is a beautiful community. Beto O'Rourke, of course, came on the scene, lit the political world on fire. Nobody saw that coming. People did see coming Ted Cruz and Donald Trump. course, there was a lot of disdain for both of them, even among some Republicans. So we've had so many new people come onto the scene, newly minted Democrats. And some of them, Arnie, told me that this online convention, the largest online convention in the history of the world, apparently, because we do have, you know, giant political parties in Texas. There's a lot of people here.
People were so motivated to participate. That's a sign of excitement and wanting to belong.
On one day alone, they said they had about 110,000 views of the live stream of this. And it was, you can imagine what it was. There were panel discussions about different things like voting rights and, you know, legislative priorities and things like that. And then there were speeches from Elizabeth Warren and Kamala Harris and Joe Biden live streamed. And they had, it was sort of eerie, Arnie. I was asked by the party to come in. I wanted to participate in both party conventions. I always do every 2 years. And they asked if I would come in and interview the caucus chairs of the Senate Democratic Caucus and House Democratic Caucus in the Texas Legislature. They were streaming this from, it was fun. It was streamed from the Sheraton in Round Rock, Texas, in an otherwise empty ballroom, as they were, you know, showing off their policy positions and talking about, you know, what they think about the Republican leadership and all of that. But they raised about $2 million for the party, which is more than they raised in all of the 2016 cycle, by the way. But they did this telling people, we're doing an online, you stay at home convention because you need to stay safe from COVID-19. And at the same time, the Supreme Court of Texas, as you remember, has argued and said now, has ruled that lack of immunity to COVID-19 is not a physical disability, meaning that people can't apply for mail-in ballots on that basis in Texas. So Democrats will now at some point have to turn around and convince people to go vote in person. Look, Arnie, I get it. And I've said this before. I'm going to say it again because it bears repeating. It's absolutely the right thing. If Democrats disagree with the policy on voter ID, mail-in ballots, et cetera, to fight it in the legislature, fight it in the courts, et cetera. But at some point before the election, you have to run in the same election the Republicans are running in, right? You can't just keep complaining that you don't like the rules the way they are set up. At some point, you've got to talk to people and level with people and say, you have to go vote in person. I wrote a column about this week at quorumreport.com. I basically concluded by saying, look, quite a conundrum and a trap that's been set by the Republicans for the Democrats. At some point, the minority party has to go and convince people that they've told to stay home, to get out of their house and go vote, because they're telling people, when it comes to this Black Lives Matter stuff and everything else, your vote, basically your life is dependent on your vote. And now they have to go tell people to do something that they've told them might endanger their lives. It's quite a conundrum.
It is a conundrum, but I'm going to sort of talk a little bit about what happened in Georgia this week, which is a total...
Yeah, what a disaster.
What a disaster. But at least let me remind everyone what Texas has that, in a way, I'm jealous of. You have early voting.
We do.
Now they've extended early voting by
3 weeks.
No week.
Yeah,
exactly.
People have 3 weeks to go vote.
3 weeks. That is, if you don't, at least you can't protect people from having to leave their house. At least you've given them a 3 week window,
right,
which people need to sort of figure out. I almost wish they could sort of stagger it and say, you know, this letter of the alphabet can show up before noon, this letter of the alphabet can, and therefore, yeah, people at least know there won't be anything in the way of lines. People will be able to be responsible in giving people assistance when they want to vote, but that 3 weeks does at least take some of the pressure off and the kind of meltdown that we saw in Georgia. So let me give you at least some kudos for that. It's not what people really should have, but it's better than what we saw in Georgia.
Yeah, in Texas, people do now have, usually it's 2 weeks, they now have 3 weeks to vote, yes, early in this July 14th runoff, and I believe we're going to have the same thing for the general election in November. And as bad as Trump has been, Arnie, on so many issues, on so many fronts, and the way that he has behaved, and you hear it from not just Democrats, but from Republicans, that they're disgusted by his behavior. Sometimes we will joke around here that, you know, the Democratic Party will find some way to mess this up and not win. You know, the ineptitude of the Democrats will be on full display, but I've kind of moved past that. It's almost like if Americans and generally Texans specifically don't reject what Trump is doing, then it'll still say United States on the map. But is it the same United States you knew before?
I'll send you a copy of an op-ed that I wrote. Because what I said was that the 2020 election is not about Democrat or Republican. It's that our values are on the line. This is an election about our values. This is not about choosing a Democrat or a Republican. It is about who and what we value. And I think that's really important. Let me just point something else out, just because really quickly, President Trump is coming to Texas to talk about race relations. This is incredible kicker, everyone. While in Dallas, he didn't invite the police chief, the sheriff, or the district attorney. Now you may ask, what do those three individuals have in common? They happen to be people of color.
The whole conversation is supposed to be about police and relations with the minority community. And he's going to Dallas for a fundraiser where couples are expected to spend a little more than $500,000 each to attend this fundraiser at a wealthy man's home there in Dallas. But for the discussion on race relations and the police, no, none of those people were invited because, of course, they were not.
That actually needs to be an op-ed in the New York Times. I mean, again, he's coming because there are deep pockets in Texas. There's an incredible amount of wealth. So he's going to come home with a haul. More importantly, however, is that how do you talk race and how do you talk police when those three pivotal players are not participating? It means he's not talking about race. He's not talking about police. You know, this is all a scam for him to actually raise money. I mean, let's be honest here.
I am really astonished, especially during the early days of the Trump administration, how well Saturday Night Live was able to parody the guy when you would think that it would be beyond parody. You could just show the videos of what actually had happened all week. It's amazing.
It is truly amazing. All right, last but not least, there have been a lot
Trump saved that show, by the way. Trump saved that show.
Oh, he did. Of course he did. Of course he did. So you talked to me about the Texas GOP county chairman who is coming under fire for sharing racist conspiracy theories online. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this I love. A prominent black member of the Texas GOP says, quote, "There are some people with hoods and robes in the party, and I know who they are." So can I invite this guy on my show?
You can. He might talk to you. His name is JT Edwards. He's a member of the State Republican Executive Committee from Galveston County. And Arnie, last year, he was called a, quote, typical nig by the Galveston County GOP chair in a text message that was shared and reported at the Galveston County Daily News, which is the oldest newspaper in Texas. Just throw that in. Edwards and I were talking earlier this week. He's a good friend and somebody who has been a good source for me. We were talking off the record about the various county chairmen who over the last couple of weeks have been shown to have shared these racist memes. And one of them from Harris County, that's where Houston is, on his Facebook had put up a MLK quote with a picture of a Chiquita banana, which he's now stepping aside after that. The Bexar County Republican chairwoman, that's where San Antonio is, she's the one who had questioned whether or not the George Floyd murder was all staged up to make President Trump look bad. Governor Abbott, Lieutenant Governor Patrick, and other prominent Republicans have asked her to step aside. As I was talking to Edwards about this, he said, look, and he's, you know, in the thick of GOP activism all the time. He said, there are some people with hoods and robes in this party, and I know who they are. And as I said, we were talking off the record. And then he demanded, Scott, you should quote me on that.
Tell him it's going to get quoted nationally
He said, you need to put that out there. I wasn't even asking him for it. I didn't say, hey, can I quote that? He just said, you need to put that out there. He did get immediately, I was told, some quick pushback from some folks in the Republican Party and others asking the question, who are you talking about? Who do we need to get rid of? Starting a real conversation. And he just, I think the man's just, he's tired, Arnie. He's tired of putting up with it. He's been doing Republican politics for years as a black man in Southeast Texas, where he often talks about the fact that the Republican Party of Texas was founded by black people. It was all about emancipation. And to see what has happened in the party in the meantime is just heartbreaking for somebody like him who really is proud of the roots of the party.
I want to remind everyone that the reason why I am in politics is because the Republican majority leader in the New Hampshire legislature invited me to run in 1984. So I am listening to what you're saying about this African-American member of the GOP in Texas. And I am telling you that the Republican Party has changed. It has lost its soul. I would love to interview him. So I'm going to make sure that you connect us. Scott Braddock is the editor of the Quorum Report. He's the voice of Texas. He's the dean of the Austin Press Corps. God, look at the material he gives us. Thank you so much. We'll schmooze next week.
Thanks, Arnie. Talk soon.
You're welcome. When we come back, Bill Curry from the great state of Connecticut.
Leaky Lavatories on this current cast. Would you flush hundreds of gallons of unused water down the drain each day? Probably not. But if you have a leaky toilet, you could be wasting that much without knowing it. Karen Worth of the Environmental Protection Agency's WaterSense program explains how to check your toilet for leaks.
If you have a tank-type toilet, place a few drops of food coloring in the tank. If that color shows up in the bowl within like 15 seconds without flushing it, that's a sure sign that you have a leak in your toilet.
The most common cause is a worn-out flapper, which is easy and inexpensive to fix. CurrentCast is produced in partnership with Cornell's Atkinson Center for a Sustainable Future. Learn more online at currentcast.org.
Welcome back to part two of the Friday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and, of course, her producers, Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Every other Friday, we hang out with Bill Curry. Bill Curry is a former Democratic nominee for governor in the great state of Connecticut, an advisor to Bill Clinton. He has been an op-ed writer at Salon.com. Again, one of the most thoughtful progressive thinkers, I think, in the United States. We are honored to have him. In the last 2 weeks, Bill, you know, I keep thinking Monday seems like a year ago. 2 weeks seems like a decade. Let's talk about sort of what has both transpired over the last 2 weeks. But you sent me an interesting comment. You wrote, Joe Scarborough and fallen Buffalo protester Martin Gugino must sue Trump for defamation. Each has an ironclad case. It would be the first time Trump was held accountable for a lie. So let's talk about the lie in Trump. And accountability. Putting those two things in the same sentence seems hard to imagine.
Remembering that propagandistic lying is the absolute quintessence of fascism and of right-wing dictators of all sorts, but especially, but truly fascist is the most accurate and helpful word to use in this context. And everybody's failed. The White House press corps is terrible. They all ought to be taken, they all ought to be taken to compulsory moot court classes where they're taught to ask questions properly. That there ought to be a simple rule. When you ask a question, ask yourself about your own question, this question. Once I've asked it, if he doesn't answer, will I even be able to say you didn't answer? Or will my own question have been so amorphous, such jello, that he could wade in and out of it without ever paying a price? And a set of other things. But the press corps has done horribly. The Democratic Party's done horribly. The Congress has been impotent to have real oversight. Trump continues doing what he's done all his life. This is the greatest proven liar in the history of American public life. Sure. It's a grand statement, and it is impossible to rebut. So, after all these institutional failures, the party, the Congress, the press, there is this one thing we have called tort law. And there's a tort law defamation action. Ralph Nader has a tort museum in Winsted, very fine thing. I had the privilege of helping to tour Justice Breyer through it last year. The reasons for this, and it sounds like it might just be sort of
it's a reminder, it's a civil action. It's not a criminal action. So in a way—
That's right. It's a civil action, although there's big penalties for lying in your deposition. But exactly. Yes, it's a civil action. And he has no defenses to appearing in court, as people have pointed out. This isn't part of his job to defame people. So he has to testify. He'll put it off and he'll fight it. But as Trump taught us with Zelensky in Ukraine, just getting an investigation going can be helpful. You know, he didn't want an actual investigation. He just wanted an announcement. Here, there's something more. You can actually begin the process. You can announce what questions he'll be answering under oath. All of his other lies are admissible in this case.
Yes.
Okay. This isn't a criminal. There, for a variety of reasons, his pattern of lying is admissible. So he can be made to swear under penalty of perjury on whichever of his 20,000 lies you find most appealing. And a substantial number, a good quarter of them, are defamatory, maybe half. And so you have something. Another problem with Trump's lies is that he tells so many of them each day, and there's a fresh stock the next day, that it's impossible to keep any lie in the public mind long enough to really, really defrock it, to really show what it is. In this case, someone as prominent as Scarborough, Mr. Gugino from Buffalo, bringing that case, announcing those questions, the heat on Trump would be enormous. Lastly, some of your listeners will know about called punitive damages. Punitive damages in tort cases, it varies from state to state. I'd love to see Scarborough bring his case in my own home state of Connecticut. I'd be glad to help. But he could actually probably bring it in Florida, where the punitive damages are unlimited. And if you want to finally get Trump's attention, you get him where it hurts. You get him in the pocketbook. I have no trouble envisioning a $100 million verdict. None.
Why is defamation not on the table right now? And what I love about these two men is that they're so different. You know, one is this sort of mild-mannered Catholic worker in his 70s, you know, who's just standing there. And you got the tape. And then, of course, you've got, you know, Joe Scarborough, who everybody in Washington tunes into, no matter which side of the political aisle, including Donald Trump. So in a lot of ways, they're interesting bookends, you know, because they represent—
They absolutely are. Right. And by the way, Trump could be the world's first defendant in a class action defamation suit. We are not searching for plaintiffs here. They're just jumping out of the woodwork. But yes, from the moment people, I don't know why no one else has thought of this, and I am going to write about it the next day or two.
But
the other thing about this is the case is so ironclad. The moment you bring it and explain just a few of the points I've just made, the entire press will understand that Trump's going to lose.
Yeah.
And they'll pay attention to it. And there will finally be one place where you can plant the flag of truth. And to all those nobles who met with King John in Runnymede and gave us the Magna Carta, and for all those farmers who developed the common law of property in England in the 12th and 13th centuries, I would just like to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. This is the last thing. All the so-called tort reforms and other legal reforms pushed by the corporate community, they are all about taking away the quintessential American rights, the right to vote and the right to your day in court. They're going after both of them. That one right, that institution, the common law, as applied through tort law by the courts, is the one last institution that might be strong enough to curb the greatest pandemic of lying ever to threaten a democracy in our time.
Oh my God, right this
So there's a, you know.
Oh my God.
And it would be a fabulous thing to watch. And they all like money. I'm sure Mr. Gugino would give his away to more peace causes, and Scarborough can keep his. Who cares?
Well, no, I actually think, yeah, I love the idea at the end that, you know, there's a potential here for a class action lawsuit. I think that's even more.
Yes, it is. I know. The world's kind of like, the first defendant in a class action defamation suit, Donald Trump. And by the way, everybody would win. We'd finally find out how much money he has.
Oh, my God. That's right. That's right. How many checks can you write with Thomas in?
Yeah, because he'd claim he couldn't pay it.
Yeah. That's right. He'd plead poverty. Yeah. Oh, my God. That's right. Who I want to talk about is Bill Barr. Yeah. And I want to talk about Bill Barr in part because of what happened with that judge who was being asked to look into the idea of dropping the case against Flynn. And I almost think that there needs to be a way that somebody buys time on every TV and radio station and just reads what the judge said about Bill Barr and his decision to drop this case. The level of outrage and disgust and appall and abuse, I think people need to hear it. This is a judge talking about the actions of our attorney general. I mean, this is not The Onion. This is real. And it is so frightening to me, Bill.
It's not The Onion. Are you sure?
I know.
You sure, Arnie?
Huh? I know, Josh.
Did you by any chance see, it was referenced again, I'd forgotten this existed, but there was an article in a newspaper called The Florida Flambeau.
No.
By a young schoolmate of the young Bill Barr, explaining what a racist and a bully Barr was, and how Barr was his high school tormentor, who made his life miserable, who picked on him, who called him awful names, who was clearly already an extremist right winger, but also someone who beat up on people. And of course, it's what he, you know, you look at Barr, he's a bully. You know, he's so many bad things. He is, again, just as Trump has lapped James Buchanan, Richard Nixon, and Warren Harding in the worst president sweepstakes, Bill Barr just left John Mitchell in his dust for worst attorney general in American history. He truly has fascist tendencies. Even when he's trying to write for respectable publications in these last 20 years, he's constantly writing about the need to let dad do everything. Let the president be completely unfettered, because after all, it's dad and he can do whatever he wants. You know, it is patriarchy incarnate, undistilled. He's done some horrible things here, and we have to find a way to take into account.
Just the other day, we interviewed two professors who run the Carrie Chapman Katz Center for Gender and Women in Politics or whatever. And they wrote about the 19th Amendment. Amazing nugget of information. I'm going to share it with everybody because I think it's so important. Was that, do you know when the first protests were in front of the White House? 1917. It was the suffragettes. It was the first time ever, Bill, that people protested in front of the White House. Wait, it gets better. It gets better. Guess what Wilson did? After a while, and they were silent. They didn't even speak.
Had them all
they were
shot.
Just silent for days. Wait. Wilson had 33 of the suffragettes arrested, thrown into prison, beaten and tortured, and fed maggot food. Finally, a judge had to be called in to say that the actions of the president was unconstitutional. Take a look at that 1917. It was the suffragettes. And then watch what Barr did when he, I guess Barr was the one that ordered in those troops. I mean, I didn't know he had the authority to do this.
I love them. I love the argument, though, between Barr and the White House as to whose idea it was. Tom Cotton going before his caucus saying it's time for Republicans to understand that blacks have a different experience. Watching these guys scramble is fun. Wilson was probably upset. The suffragettes were probably chanting while he was trying to watch Birth of a Nation.
Oh, stop. But when I look at that arc of history and look at the suffragettes and how Wilson responded and look what Trump is doing with Bill Barr in front of the White House, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, what has changed? But what does this last 2 weeks mean for the November election? What does it mean for participation? What does it mean for Joe Biden's agenda? What does the term defund the police mean? What do all these activities mean when you want to translate it into what has to happen if Donald Trump is to be removed. Is this a moment of like a tipping point, or is this going to complicate the fight for the Democratic Party as they're trying to figure out how they sort of stabilize themselves in order to organize to basically effectively eliminate Donald Trump in 2020?
Well, let me just say, I want to actually get one other little completely unrelated idea out about the last part of our conversation,
okay,
and I'll go
absolutely
right to that. And the unrelated idea is, I just wanted to use your show to renew my semi-annual call for taking J. Edgar Hoover's name off the FBI building. And it should be no, that's right. It should be no surprise that we would have a fascist Justice Department while we still have that guy's name on the building. It should have come off the day Martin Luther King's statue went up. And I've been doing this every couple of years for a couple
write
of decades.
Write that piece. Oh, my God.
And the man, we know he broke scores and scores and scores of laws in the name of politicizing the FBI for the purposes of political oppression. Could you just take his damn name off the building? Could we just do that? Now, about this moment, on a happier note, let me just say, I am one of those people who's in like Prozac heaven over the last 2 weeks in the end. I mean, you know, maybe it's just the meds, but I haven't felt so optimistic about the long-term character of the country in quite a few years, not just the Trump years, although
I'm
these have been, for all people who aspire to being decent people, the worst years, just about all people like that.
I'm sort of inspired too. I got called by NBC News yesterday to talk about Joe Biden's VP pick. And now there's this real pressure for him to pick a woman of color. I started the conversation by saying, let me tell you who inspired me into politics. I said, who inspired me into politics in 1984 was a black woman named Shirley Chisholm, who showed up in my white state to address a group of hundreds of poverty workers, of which I was one of them. And for the most part, 98% of us were women, right? And she gets up and gives a speech, Bill. And I thought that everyone in the room had disappeared and that I was having a personal conversation with Shirley Chisholm. Because she was talking about the fact that if you are frustrated by what's happening to your clientele, if you realize the system doesn't understand them, that I'm going to direct you to take an action you may be afraid to take. And that is, you need to get political. And I don't mean just vote. You need to put your neck on the line and your life on the line. You need to run for office. You need to be at the table to affect change. That was 1984, Bill. And that was the woman that inspired me, who was the biggest risk taker, the first black woman to run for president of the United States. I just want everyone to remember. So when I talked about the fact, is this a moment for a black woman VP? I went, if not now, when? And I think the person who should be cheering them on is Elizabeth Warren going, let me help you, Joe. I think this is a great idea. Who are we going to choose? There are so many remarkable leaders.
There are. Let me just say, that said, if I had to choose between Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, I'd go with Elizabeth Warren.
Oh, no, I agree with you.
There are plenty of good candidates, so let's make sure we get one of the good ones.
Yeah.
I'll just repeat something you've heard me say before, and that is that the United States of America is deeply divided in its views on almost all questions of public policy by gender, by race, by age, and even by locality, urban versus rural, for instance, for that matter, urban versus suburban, often enough. But the Democratic Party is not. The Democratic Party, if you look at what people feel about issues, what my own research has showed me, just my research consisting of taking out a bunch of polls and looking at them where I can find the demographic breakdowns, that when it comes to almost all the issues that crowd for our attention, the differences between black Democrats and white Democrats, young Democrats and old Democrats, male Democrats and female Democrats, even rural and urban Democrats, not that great. The great divide within our party is between our progressive populist base and our donor-driven elected officials. That's the great fjord in the Democratic Party that needs to be healed and bridged. And above all, the great mistake of 2016, which most of the media missed, was that Hillary Clinton treated Sanders and his agenda like dogs kicked to the curb the moment the primary was over, and let Trump walk away with a drain the swamp. We gave Trump not only reactionary cultural populism, rather, but progressive economic populism. He was the one with the powerful ads about corporations taking over Washington. Okay, now, he's a liar, and it's all just a, you know, it's all just one big lie. But so we have to make sure, both one, to win the election, and two, then to govern in a way that really, really maximizes what we've achieved by winning the election.
Well, I think we need to bring that in.
And I just want to make sure, I don't have an easy answer. I would love to see a woman of color. These are all great things. But the great struggle in my party has been between the neoliberal DLC faction that's expressly, publicly said they were out to undo the New Deal, and the people who were trying to reestablish at least the basic premises of FDR. I want to make sure we don't lose sight of that in this. As I wrote to you, my first pick for Veep would be Julie Louis-Dreyfus, who's the only candidate out there with experience in the job. Other than that, I'm not sure who it should be.
Now, let me just remind everyone. So one of the things the reporter said to me yesterday was, who is prepared to be president? You know, that whoever the person picks is prepared to be president. And I said, if I showed you the bio of Barack Obama and I didn't tell you who it was,
right,
would you have assumed that that person was ready to be president? His resume was so politically thin, Bill. It is absolutely incredible. He was a state senator in Illinois for I don't know how many years. No real positions of authority. He was a U.S. senator for probably less than a year before he threw his name into the ring. If you just saw his resume and I did not tell you who he was, you would have said, oh, there's not enough heft there. There's not enough preparation there. And I just want people to understand that, in a way, this is a job that the job description is about temperament, curiosity, the kind of people that you want to attract, your ability. It is not your typical CEO of IBM. I am sorry. It is a very, very different skill set. And people don't quite appreciate that.
It is. Although having real political experience, I am. When Stacey Abrams, who hasn't won a statewide race and has just been a state rep in the minority, moreover, it's a big, big leap. And I also would like to know more about what she really thinks. The one thing I don't want to make, the mistake the Democratic Party often makes, we do not question our candidates nearly as closely as the Republicans do.
Absolutely.
Nobody sneaks through the Republican vetting machine. Democrats don't want to ask questions that make their candidates feel uncomfortable. And it's a really bad trait.
So MSNBC had Joe Biden and Stacey Abrams on. And the question I want to ask Stacey Abrams is, when she was in the Georgia State Senate, why did she overturn a Georgia Supreme Court decision that protected consumers against banks? Why did she actually initiate and help pass a bill where the Georgia Supreme Court actually was being receptive to the needs and the protections of the consumer? And why did she not only support that, but basically help to write the bill to overturn that? You just mentioned, what's the difference in the party? It's not about ideas. It's a difference between what the progressives believe and what those corporate elite believe that are being driven by banks and credit card companies and Wall Street and hospitals and pharma. That's the difference. When you look at who the biggest contributor of pharma in the entire U.S. Senate, it was the guy that basically put through the Affordable Care Act. Well, who benefited from the Affordable Care Act but Big Pharma? They got the illusion of change, and yet they still benefited financially.
Big Pharma and the insurance industry profited. They were the biggest winners by far. You know, and so again, where does this leave us? I still like Elizabeth Warren, but I feel like, you know, I get that the Massachusetts thing is difficult. If Biden wants to pick Warren, he has to pick her right now. She has to resign right now so that there can be a special election in November to fill her seat so that there's a Democrat to make the rules. And that means finding out what Charlie Baker's thinking, because he's the only Republican who could win that seat. There's a whole lot of groundwork that could be done. I like Val Demming. She's more of a moderate. I like moderates who, I get the feeling, if they're a little more conservative than I am in some issues, but I get that they're responding to their voters rather than their donors. Fine, I can work with that. And I get the feeling with Val Demming that I like the feel of, I like her bio. I like that this is a strong black woman who was a police chief, and she's in a swing state. She could help us take Florida. Yeah. And those are all very conventional considerations. And she's not quite as progressive. She wouldn't help that divide the way I spoke about it a minute ago, but she wouldn't be mortgaged to the donors. She'd be sitting there with a real open mind, and I think at her heart, a populist conscience. So I like Val Demming. I just think Stacey Abrams, I wish she'd run for the Senate. I'll work for her hard to be governor, and I then might work for her to be president, but I want to know more about what she feels, and I don't think she's quite ready.
Exactly.
And Kamala Harris is too much of a donor Democrat. Again, if she's the nominee, I'll be automatically thrilled the next morning. I will make myself thrilled, I promise.
Oh, God.
And that goes to your last question that you asked, and that is, so what is this moment? And again, I just think it's important for progressives to differentiate. I was thinking about Eddie Markey's race. If I were in Massachusetts, I'd be helping Eddie Markey over Joe Kennedy, and they're both fine. But Eddie has been that rare, there aren't a half dozen, who for years has been using his office to help progressives. It's a place to hang your hat and get a little strategic advice, a little networking, not just a vote. And that way, he was more like Teddy Kennedy. When I was with the nuclear freeze, Eddie was one of the two or three members of Congress most out front on it. All these years later, the Green New Deal is doing the same thing. Wow. We're about to go into, we have to just band together and win this, period, in November. And then after that, it shifts. And the handful of people like AOC and Markey who are using their offices to help a movement organize, to pressure the system, I want more of those. And that's our next step, because the possibilities for change will be the greatest since the 1960s, for sure. We can, for all we've been through, if we take a Democratic Senate and we're tied or ahead in 10 frigging races right now of Republican incumbents,
it must be stunning.
And if we can take the Senate, even a mushy centrist Democratic president could become historic with how much.
And on that note, ending with my mushy centrist Democratic president.
And I think you know who I'm talking about.
I think I know who you're talking about, Bill Curry. Bill Curry joins us every 2 weeks. He's a fabulous progressive commentator. We're so glad that he joins us. Talk to you too. Ciao.
See you soon.
All right, bye-bye. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. See you next week. You bet.